The global economy is seriously at risk because there's simply too much debt sloshing around the world today. And there are only two ways to deal with the problem. Either we let the excess debts go into default, which is called deflation, or we fire up the money printers and pay the debts in vastly diluted currency, which is called inflation. Each option requires a vastly different playbook for investors looking to protect and grow their wealth. So which outcome is more likely? Today's guest, market researcher Luke Grohman, is confident that he has the answer.
You know, your bonds went from buying you diamonds in 1946 to buying you cubic zirconia by 1966. And by 1980, it was buying you Cracker Jack on a string to wear around your neck. And so I think they're going to run the same playbook. And I think we are in very early days of that.
Hello and welcome to Peak Prosperity. I am Peak Prosperity co-founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back for another week of making sense of money and the markets. And this week we have a very special guest. I'm very pleased to welcome Luke Grohman to the program. Luke's the founder of Forest for the Trees, a macro thematic research firm catering to institutions and individuals that aggregates a wide variety of macroeconomic, thematic, and sector trends into an unconventional manner, which identifies investable developing economic bottlenecks for their customers. I'll let Luke explain what those are, but his firm has found that excess investment returns tend to accrue to economic bottlenecks over time, which is why they're so important to pay attention to. Luke, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Adam. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you. I'm excited to have you here. Well, real quick before we dig into it, can you just explain really quickly what an economic bottleneck is and why your firm pays such attention to it?
Absolutely. So an economic bottleneck is basically where you've got, to use a metaphor, a rock meeting a hard place. There's forces coming together, a confluence of actors or factors or events that are creating some sort of vacuum that needs to be filled or resolved. And so, for example, an economic bottleneck was we had in 2005, 2006, 2007, we had a big housing bubble. Subprime credit was cut off to a large extent at some point along that. And as subprime credit was cut off, we had a bottleneck. The bottleneck was the application of credit to the housing market at the subprime level. Without that subprime credit, the housing market had a problem, and it was resolved by, of course, home prices falling sharply and a financial crisis and et cetera. And so it's been my experience that, and the reason we focus on thematic and sectors and macro is at the end of the day, when you identify one of these big economic bottlenecks, for example, the subprime housing example I used, it doesn't matter which home builder you bought. Maybe you bought the best home builder, but that means it just went down 60% instead of 90%. Or if you bought the best subprime bank or best home lender, it went down 90% instead of 100%. So for me, it's really about addressing these macro or thematic factors that in the example where the removal of a big chunk of subprime credit that is supporting the housing market, consumption, et cetera, as was the case back in 05 to 08, that we're really looking to identify as sort of those types of macro factors. And that's what we mean by an economic bottleneck.
Great. Makes total sense to me. Am I sort of succinctly summarizing correctly by saying you look at sort of shifts of the tide, ones that will raise all boats or lower all boats?
I think that's exactly right. I think there's a great quote by William Arthur Ward says the optimist expects the wind to change. The pessimist complains about the wind. The optimist expects it to change, but the realist adjusts the sails. And that's really what we're trying to do is we're trying to sort of connect the dots, put the tea leaves together and adjust the sales accordingly.
All right, great. Well, look, I like to kick off these interviews with a general question before I introduce any potential bias. So that question is, can you just share with us your current assessment of today's economy and financial markets?
Yes. My assessment of the economy and financial markets is that I think the financial markets are extremely fragile. I think the economy is extremely uneven. So that you've got the economy is really a tale of two cities, or you can call it K-shaped. As some of it, some people have called it a K-shaped recovery, but you've got on one hand an absolute booming economy, and for others a very difficult economy. And so I think the economy is very uneven overall. The financial markets are extraordinarily fragile, I think. And I think we're in a very historically unique period of time. We've got the first, what we've called the first bursting global sovereign debt bubble in 100 years since the immediate aftermath of World War I. And you've also got the first time in 50 to 70 years that foreign central banks are no longer growing their holdings of treasuries, which means foreign central banks are no longer financing the U.S. government on net. That started in the third quarter of 2014. Prior to that, that had not happened in at least 50 years and maybe more like 70 years. And you also have the first time in at least 50 years where you're seeing a move away from or a marked shift in a key underpinning of the currency system, where for 50 years, oil was priced solely in dollars. And increasingly, that's no longer the case. You're seeing this move towards multi-currency energy pricing and more broadly commodity pricing. And so you've got this uneven economic recovery in terms of the real economy with the K-shaped recovery. And then you've got this global sovereign debt bubble. You've got a foreign central bank ceasing to finance the U.S. government. And you've got this shift in the underlying currency system. When I say a sovereign debt bubble, I think the best way to think about it is back in 2000, we had an equity bubble. It burst and policymakers kicked the problem upstairs to the housing market, to the banking system. Paul McCulley and Paul Krugman famously said, we need a housing bubble to offset the demand hit from the stock bubble. And so they had a housing bubble. They had a banking system bubble that burst, and they kicked that problem upstairs to the sovereign level. The governments came in, backstopped effectively everything. Now we have a sovereign debt bubble, which is to say they're sort of backstopping everything. There's nowhere else to kick it upstairs to. You can't kick the sovereign debt problem up to Mars. Maybe Elon Musk would like to, but that's not going to happen, certainly not in any relevant time frame. And so if you have a sovereign debt bubble, what that looks like is one of two things. That looks like either sovereign debt gets defaulted on or sovereign debt gets paid back in devalued dollars. And so a sovereign debt bubble is really a fiat currency bubble. And all of this is sort of mishmash of uneven economic recovery and these systemic, seismic shifts in the real bedrock of the system are all combining to make for very fragile financial markets.
All right. Well, very well said. And I like to ask that question really to give you the opportunity to let folks know kind of exactly where you stand without any leading from me. I will say that it seems like your outlook is very similar to many of the past guests we've had on this program, many of whom you know, Luke, because they're in your peer group. But the important thing that I want to underscore to people is I don't bring on guests like you on this program because you have an outlook that fits a specific narrative. I try to bring on people who are just very data-driven, data-centric. Also, like you, have a study history, just bring people on that call it as they see it. But there's a lot of people right now, smart people like you, who, you know, are looking at the data and coming to a lot of the same conclusions. So anyways, you talk about the sovereign debt bubble, which, you know, is a can that can't be kicked up to a higher pay grade. It's at the highest pay grade here. You sort of gave your, hey, there's sort of one of two options here, right? We let some of those bad debts just start defaulting, which is very painful in the immediate term, or we pay that debt away with inflated currency, which is just as destructive in the long term, but maybe takes longer to happen, right? So it's generally oftentimes favored by the politicians. Do you have a strong proclivity one way or the other that you think this is going to go?
I do. I think it's ultimately going to be inflated away simply because the alternative is too painful. And when I say it's too painful, I think you have to take a look at the structure. And I spend a lot of my time looking at the U.S. fiscal situation. It's the biggest economy still. B, it's the reserve currency issuer. So if you look at the U.S.'s fiscal situation, for example, one of the metrics I look at is the big three, or the big three expenditures of the United States government. So that's entitlements, Social Security and Medicare, defense, and Treasury spending, which used to be primarily interest. Now it's interest and stimulus payments as well. But the point is that if you go back to 2016, the big three expenditures were around 75 to 80% of total U.S. federal tax receipts. When the Fed started raising rates, it slowed the economy. So it slowed tax receipts while it accelerated interest payments or interest expense. And so you saw that percentage go from 70 to 80% up to near 90%. When I first did the analysis in early 2016, I thought we had until probably 2021 or early 2022 for the big three to go over 100% of tax receipts, and that was my marker of when is the U.S. fiscal situation really going to start to go critical. Because simply at that point, then you're printing the money to pay for everything else the U.S. government does. And it's quite a bit, everything else they do. Because of the interest rate hikes and the resultant economic slowdown, instead of it going over 100% by late 21, early 2022, what actually happened was by third quarter of 2018, we were at 103% of tax receipts already. So it went much faster than we thought. Of course, we had a crisis in the stock market in the fourth quarter of 18, Fed reversed rate hikes. Fast forward to the other side of COVID, we're now at 140% of federal tax receipts for just those big three, and including about 110% of tax receipts for the items that we call true interest expense. So it's U.S. Treasury spending, and then the pay-as-you-go portions of U.S. entitlements, which are really just the interest expense on the off-balance sheet obligation of the U.S. entitlements. And so basically, at this point, they need to print the money just to pay the interest on their true interest on their debt position, on their debt and debt-like obligation positions. And you're at 140%. The big three are at 140% of tax receipts. And so, what this all means in terms of the inflation or deflation metric is, deflation is always a near-term option. But if deflation, if we were looking at deflation or inflation handles, and we just said, okay, we're going to push down the deflation lever, and we're going to leave it there. 140% of tax receipts, assuming no decline in tax receipts as a result of the deflation angle, which would be actually tremendous decline in tax receipts.
Right.
140% of tax receipts means, call it within 2.5 months, the U.S. government's going to run out of money to pay defense, entitlements, or interest. And that's the problem I have with the sort of sustained deflationist view is, yes, they could theoretically do it. I don't think it's a wise bet to think that the U.S. government is going to default on its baby boom generation, on its treasury holders, or on the United States Defense Department. I just don't think it's going to happen. And if you don't think that's going to happen, then that leaves, there's only one lever, and that's they're going to print the money to pay those. And over time, as they keep doing that on a repeated basis, you end up with the U.S. government effectively dictating more and more of the economic policy, more and more of the lending policy, the monetary supply growth of the United States. And over time, once it gets big enough, once the U.S. government gets big enough as a percent of GDP, that becomes quite inflationary. And I think we're getting into the sort of, you know, I think we're beyond the early innings. I think we're getting into the third, fourth inning of this process.
All right. Okay. Number of questions coming out of that. I guess the first one is sort of another way to state what you've said, is that the U.S. is now already... it's already insolvent. The world is just letting us get away with printing to fill our insolvency hole. But obviously, at some point in time, someone's going to realize that we're just printing up pieces of paper, or really, you know, digital bytes, to cover the fact that just structurally we can't cover our expenses.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think when you look at what, for example, China's been doing since 2010, maybe 2011, there's been much press written about the Michael Saylor playbook, right? Which is he's borrowing money at effectively zero and he's buying Bitcoin, a finite asset. And we've seen that work out well for him. There's been a lot of ink spilled about what he's been doing. Where there's been a lot of less ink spilled is that China's been running the Michael Saylor playbook since roughly 2010, which is borrow in dollars and go buy copper mines,
resources around the world,
or it's just anything that, you know, hurts when it drops on your foot or is being produced at a slower rate than U.S. federal debt, which It's not hard to do these days, but in all seriousness, the U.S. government is issuing debt that yields basically zero, and that debt's been growing 9% CAGR since 2009. So it's not a good store of wealth. If storing your finite wealth in an asset where, you know, the supply of the asset's growing 9 and the coupon on the asset is never going above 3 or hasn't gone above 3, and right now is yielding zero while inflation is running above zero, you're getting your purchasing power stolen from you. And so China's just been, I think China's identified this way ahead of everybody else, and they've been running this playbook. And I think more recently, we're seeing more and more people do that. I think Bitcoin is an expression of this same trade, whether it's Michael Saylor doing it or others. And so ultimately, I think that's what we're seeing is this. And the vicious cycle of all of this is the more this goes on, the fewer treasuries that China buys in favor of other real assets. Basically, that leaves more and more of the U.S. deficits, which are growing, to be financed by the U.S. instead of by China. And so when the U.S. private sector has to finance its own deficits for the first time in 50 to 70 years, we begin to be subject to crowding out. Our economy slows. As our economy slows, we have to issue more treasuries. As we issue more treasuries, the Chinese buy less. We have to buy more. We crowd out. So we're into this vicious cycle that's been accelerating since 3Q14. And at any time, we can choose deflation. We can just say, you know what, we're going to slash spending on entitlements, defense, but that politically, that was politically unpalatable 7 years ago. I think in what we've all seen in the last 10 months, I think it's extraordinarily politically unpalatable right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. All right, so sounds like, you know, from a macro perspective, you are saying odds favor inflation. In a more tactical time frame, is it possible that deflationary forces, and maybe deflationary is the wrong word to use, but you used the word bubble a couple of times when you were talking about the fragile markets that we have or the sovereign debt bubble. Is it possible that things could get away from the central planners' desire to control the narrative and the way things unfold here, and that there can be substantial downdrafts, at least in the financial markets? And the main reason why I ask this question is, you know, it's an age-old debate over the past 10 years on the internet, how's this all going to end, deflation or inflation? And the reason why most regular people, like our viewers watching this video, ask that question is they're trying to figure out where to position their own assets, right? And I think a very common sort of conundrum that a lot of them have right now is, I totally believe in the macro inflation story, but I look at the, you know, record high levels of overvaluation of so many elements of today's markets, and I don't want to, you know, sort of push all my chips onto the inflation side of the story and then have like a 50% or more market correction, you know, like folks like, you know, very esteemed folks like Jeremy Grantham are warning of. So is it possible for things to kind of get, you know, out of the hands, out of the clutches of the central planners in the short term, and, you know, at least bring some of these bubbles back to earth?
Yeah, I think absolutely it's possible. To me, the question then becomes one of duration, of how long that would last. And so something we started looking at really even before the 2018 fourth quarter sell-off was this relationship between the stock market and US GDP. And what you find, the way there's a number of different ways you look at it. Alan Greenspan said in 2015 something really interesting that really kind of crystallized it in my own head and really set me off down the path of trying to quantify the numbers as best I can. And what he said was, it's not well known that the U.S. stock market is a big part, how big a part of tax receipts is the U.S. stock market. And that if the stock market just stops going up, let alone falls, it's quickly going to hurt U.S. tax receipts and create a fiscal problem. And so we can infer, if Alan Greenspan knows that, so does everybody at the Fed, so does everybody at the Treasury. And then you say, okay, well, why is he saying that? Because if you just look at the numbers nominally in a certain way, it doesn't look that big. And so what you have to remember is it's a very levered system, top to bottom. The government's levered, corporates are levered, consumers are levered, there's derivatives on the leverage. The system's extraordinarily levered. And then if you look at one of the ways we've looked at it is net capital gains. If you dig into IRS data, you see that net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions are around 200% of the annual growth in U.S. personal consumption expenditures, or PCE. PCE is a big category. It's everything from boats, cars, stuff you buy at Walmart, healthcare services, et cetera. But the punchline is that it's about two-thirds of U.S. GDP is PCE. So just the net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions are 200% of the annual growth in PCE, which is two-thirds of GDP. And so what that daisy chain suggests is not that people are necessarily selling stocks and taking IRA distributions and buying boats and cars and healthcare with it. But what it does strongly suggest is that it's mathematically impossible for PCE to grow if stocks fall and stay down. And if PCE doesn't grow, it's almost mathematically impossible for GDP to grow. And if GDP doesn't grow with debt to GDP at 130% in the United States, it becomes a mathematical certainty before very long, tying back to our prior point, that the U.S. government's going to default on either treasuries, entitlements, or defense within a 2.5 to 3 month time frame. And so when you sort of string that all together, what our conclusion was especially once we found, once you add in that of that 200% of PCE growth, that does not include stock options or stock comp. That's all taxed as ordinary income. So the real number is probably 225, 250, 300% of PCE. We don't know. There's no great numbers on it. You can sort of play bigger than a breadbasket, but that's about the best you can do. So what that tells you, especially since we know they know, based on Greenspan's comments and based on Bernanke's comments about, hey, why was QE successful? And the first words out of his mouth was, well, stock prices went up. And Yellen has talked about stock prices rising as being a successful policy as well, very early in the list of policy outcomes suggesting success of QE. What it suggests is that, yes, stocks can fall, but if they fall sharply, again, within months and probably now within weeks, you're going to start to see the financial system collapse. And a really good acid test of this was last March when we saw stocks fall sharply. They fell almost, the S&P, I think, fell about 20 or 22% peak to trough. And we started having the U.S. Treasury market started breaking. The deepest, most liquid market in the world. First time in my, I've been doing this 25 years. I had never seen the Treasury yield spike as stocks crashed. So basically the Treasury market started crashing alongside the equity market for the first time in my career last March. And then again in October, we saw equities down 800 points in a day. And Treasury's yields were rising. Today, take a look at what TLT did. TLT was down over 1% at one point today, with stocks down 600, with the Dow down 600 points. So there's this, because the debt has gotten so big, because foreign ownership of U.S. assets has gotten so big as a result of our prior deficits, because again, they're not buying as many Treasuries, they are buying anything but Treasuries. So the U.S.'s net international investment position has gone from negative 8% of GDP in 08 to negative 65% today. Anytime you get these sell-offs, they can happen, but what they're going to increasingly do, each sell-off, the time period is going to get shorter. It's going to put the U.S. government at risk of defaulting on treasuries, on defense, or on, you know, having the president get on TV one night and tell the baby boomers, hey, sorry, the checks aren't coming this month, maybe next month if stocks rebound. That's not going to happen in my view. So what I tell people is I would never I want to position my portfolio so that it, with an inflationary slant, but that I'm hedging somehow with you know, that I'm not so far over my skis that I can't survive a downdraft. You can't have a down, I'm not saying you can't have a downdraft, but I look at it as just stay more liquid than the U.S. government. And if we look at that 140% of tax receipts, big three, it means I got to be able to be liquid for, call it 2.5 to 3 months. Because if stocks go down 20, 30, 50% and stay down there, within 2.5, 3, 4 months, the U.S. government is going to have a serious financial problem without the Fed stepping in to print money, in which case that's going to be inflationary for asset prices like we saw last March. So it's a long-winded answer, but I think it's important to kind of give that background and just that context, because I don't think there's any right answer. But if you understand the framework of how I'm coming to the answer, then I think it can help listeners say, okay, I sort of get where he's coming from.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate. I think you did a great job of contextualizing it, and it's rough. I mean, I think you really underscored why this is such a treacherous time for investors, right? You have kind of a house of cards that, if left to natural forces, desperately wants to collapse, right? But you have everybody in the system, you know, basically pushing to keep it from doing so. And it was good context. After I talked to you, Luke, I'm going to talk to the lead partners of New Harbor Financial, whom I do every week. And your context, I think, does a really good way of sort of validating their outlook on the markets, which they have a lot of their philosophy is similar to yours. And of course, they have the challenge of, all right, how do you manage, you know, for that type of future while not getting destroyed along the way, you know, when some of these parts of the house of cards collapses? It's a really, really tough time for capital managers. So we're going to go a few minutes over, if that's okay, just because you're such a phenomenal guest. And to your point there, I guess one question for you is, you did a really good job of saying, hey, look, it's just not in the U.S., you know, government's interests for the stock market to go down and stay down because it creates so many other issues. So, you know, I'm wondering if in last March we saw the Fed put morph into the Fed plus Congress put. Where, you know, whenever we have some of these moments where things kind of, you know, get out of the control of the central planners, it's not just going to be the Fed stepping in anymore. It's going to be the Fed and Congress. It's going to be like a double barrel shotgun of stimulus now.
I think that's right. And, you know, it's interesting. Something we were writing about for clients was back in August of 2019, actually. So call it 7 months before COVID and the COVID crisis hit. And shortly before the repo spike hit in 4Q or late 3Q 19, there was a white paper written by former Fed Vice Chair Stan Fisher, former Swiss National Bank President Philip Hildebrand, and former Bank of Canada Governor Jean Boivin. And it was called Dealing with the Next Downturn, going from unconventionary monetary policy to coordinated action or something. But it was an absolute jaw dropper of a report. It hit like right in the middle of August when no one's paying attention. And by way of background for the listeners, Stan Fisher was someone that Harold Malmgren, who spent 60 years in Washington, worked for the Kennedy administration, just brilliant man, still very connected in Washington. Malmgren called Fisher one of the ultimate behind the scenes actor. And so the ultimate behind the scenes actor writes this white paper in August of 2019 and says, in the next downturn, we're going to have to go direct. Central banks are going to have to go direct. And what going direct means is not only are the central banks going to do what they do, but the fiscal authorities are going to have to spend a whole bunch of money. And then the central banks are going to have to cap yields so that the fiscal spending and the inflation that it causes does not create a rise in interest rate that offsets the stimulative benefit of the fiscal spending. So they like, and then beyond all of this white paper, they go country by country in this white paper. It's incredible. It's like a roadmap of what they have proceeded to do since then. And so I agree 100% that, yeah, I think it really has been, it's no longer the Fed put, it's the Fed plus Congress put. And it is something they began, it's been something they've been planning for.
All right. Scary, frightening, you know, maybe not totally unexpected, but still just show sort of how far down this rabbit hole we all are. All right, so I want to get to the question of, you know, that's actionable for viewers, which is, how can we invest for this type of environment? If you have any, you know, recommendations for folks, obviously not personal financial advice, but just, you know, broad brush recommendations. But before I do, because it's related to what you were just talking about there of capping rates, we had a great discussion 2 weeks ago with Stephanie Pomboy, where she and I really got into the vulnerability of the current system to rising interest rates. Luke, you have written relatively recently, I believe, that you're probably, for many of the reasons you've just outlined, you don't really see rates being allowed to go too much higher, and or at least real rates. And it seems like you think real rates actually have the probability to go lower, in fact, potentially a lot lower from here. Is that still true?
Yeah, I think coming into this year, I thought one of the biggest maybe gaps between perception or expectation and what I think would be ultimate reality is what was happening with real yields. And so it's just, nominal yields minus the inflation rate. And so if you go back to 1942 to 51, in the aftermath of World War II, which was the last time U.S. debt to GDP was this high, and global debt to GDP arguably this high in a lot of countries, what you saw was that real yields went in the United States to, I think, negative 14%. And consensus, I think it may be less so now, but certainly 3 months ago, 6 months ago, was that real yields in the United States had bottomed around August of last year at around negative 1.1%. And I think that I think before this cycle's over, we're easily going to get the negative 5 to negative 10% real yields in the United States. And importantly, if you look at the nations that were deindustrialized by World War II, both victors and losers in that war, whether you look at Japan, whether you look at France, whether you look at Italy, Australia, UK, the range of negative real rates in those countries that saw more direct war damage slash deindustrialization was negative 20 to negative 60% real rates for a period of time. For the US, there wasn't a lot of war damage. The negative 14 was sort of touched and bounced back. But even with the US being relatively undamaged, over the next 35 years, real yields were negative for the majority of the time. And nominal GDP in the United States consistently was 500 to 800 basis points above the yield on the 10-year treasury yield for the vast majority of the ensuing 35 years. So basically all that's saying is, you know, your bonds went from buying you diamonds in 1946 to buying you cubic zirconia by 1966. And by 1980, it was buying you Cracker Jack on a string to wear around your neck. And so I think they're going to run the same playbook. And I think we are in very early days of that. I think in the last month, the bond market has been sort of like the frog in the pot, and they were trying to boil the frog without him noticing. And I think in the last month, the frog sort of woke up and said, "Hey, the water's getting a little warm. I'm jumping out." And so now they have to continue the metaphor. They got a frog jumping around the kitchen. They're trying to figure out how to get him back in the pot, put the lid on the pot, and boil him, all without freaking out anything else. And I think when you see days like today, you see the risks of them not being able to grab the frog and put it back in the pot and boil it in a expedient and I'm trying to use a diplomatic word, in a nice way.
Okay. Well done. And great analogies, by the way. Days like today are exactly why these markets are so hard, right? There's so many of people viewing this. You know, they distrust asset prices so much where they are right now because they're so deformed from historic norms. And, you know, days like today can show that things can just get out of control really quickly. And is this the beginning of something bigger? Who knows? But we'll definitely, you know, be watching things here. So real rates are, they favor safety assets like gold. They also, you know, favor digital, you know, anti-fiat assets like Bitcoin. And Luke, you are one of the most recommended people that our audience has said, "Hey, please get him on the program." So I'm so glad you came on, and you certainly haven't disappointed. But I think I would disappoint them if I didn't ask you about your views on precious metals and Bitcoin, given the future that we're headed into. I know it's a big topic, and I'm not giving you a lot of time, but you know, succinctly, what can you say about your position on that?
Sure. So I think the most important thing to remember is it is going to be extraordinarily difficult to trade the first bursting global sovereign debt bubble in 100 years, the biggest change in a currency system in 50 years, and the biggest, the first time the U.S. government's effectively been defunded by global central banks. So you've got these big tectonic plate shifts going on. They create a lot of volatility. And a chart we've used for our clients a number of times from a friend of ours, Dan Oliver at Mermican Capital, is simply brilliant. And what it shows is that the price of gold in German Reichsmarks from 1914 to 1923, as the German Reichsmark was ultimately hyperinflating to zero, gold was going from whatever to a trillion Reichsmarks, right? So just up in 9 years. Within that, though, if you were levered long gold in German Reichsmark, as the currency was going to zero, you lost all of your money four or five different times because the political volatility around the systemic shifts that were happening were so great. So I think it's important to recognize as an investor, and particularly precious metal and crypto investor, Bitcoin investor, is the environment we are in is hyper-political. And that's the part that you have no visibility over, you have no control over. It can move against you viciously, like you see like days like today or even the last couple months for gold. But that ultimately, you take a look out, the only way out, the only politically palatable way out is significantly negative real rates. And over time, gold and Bitcoin do really well in environments where real rates are significantly negative. And so for me, I have big positions in both. I continue to have big positions in both. Days like today, I don't look at my screen. it sucks. It's tough. But I really think it's important to recognize the historically unique operating environment we're in, and just be cognizant that you're better off being unlevered. People say, "Well, I want, if gold's going to go up a bunch and there's going to be a reset, or crypto's going to go to whatever, I want to be as levered as possible." And that's 100% the wrong thing to do this in this environment. The right thing to do is be unlevered, because the system has all the leverage you're going to need to allow those assets to outperform on an unlevered basis. And so you just want to be there at the finish line if/when, in my view, it happens. So that's what I would say is I continue to really like gold and silver and Bitcoin. And I think ultimately it's really, look, you've got a sovereign debt bubble. It's bursting. It's global. It's particularly bad in the advanced economies. They need significantly negative real rates. There's no way around that, in my view. And as long as that remains true, then you stay the course. And, you know, if things change geopolitically, if things change, you know, if we wake up tomorrow and Biden comes out and says, we're cutting baby boomers' entitlements by 30 or 40%, well, I'm going to need to revisit my gold and my Bitcoin at that point. Oh my gosh, we're going to do severe austerity. I don't think it's very likely, but those are the types of sort of big signposts I'm watching for that would really change my view on gold or Bitcoin in a meaningful way. But other than that, it's just about sort of, you know, holding on for dear life in both, to borrow the phrase from the crypto people.
All right. Well, I think that's a really important mindset, which you're saying, look, this is going to be a game that's going to have lots of ups, lots of downs. There's going to be all sorts of changes being made across the political landscape, where some assets are going to be in favor, some aren't going to be. And what you just want to do is create a portfolio and a strategy that gets you as safely as possible across the finish line, that there's going to be so much collateral damage in here that just making across the finish line is going to make you relatively better off than probably most investors who aren't paying attention. I'm going to ask you just for a really quick answer on this, and I know we could have a whole interview on this topic, but you said you still like Bitcoin. We have talked about it a little bit on this program. I will say that there's still a lot of wood we need to chop to really, you know, make all of its pros and cons understood to this viewing audience. What are the things about it that you find most favorable going forward? And if you have any concerns, what are your top concerns about it?
Yeah, to me, it's just digital gold. I think it's a reserve asset for the people. I think it does a lot of the things that gold does in an easier, better way than gold does, in terms of its ease of use, ease of moving, ease of centralization or decentralization. It makes it much more resilient against manipulation because it's decentralized. There are still some things it doesn't do as well. It's not held on sovereign balance sheets. It is still, there will always be an energy debt owed to Bitcoin in terms of the electricity needed to run the network. And that is not true for physical gold held in your person. That is final payment, nobody else's liability. So there, I just look at Bitcoin as in Bitcoin in particular, primarily because it's the technologists that I talk to say just Bitcoin is the one you really want to focus on. And I've not done the technologist side work to say, yeah, you know, you also should look at this, that, or the other. So I stick strictly with Bitcoin on that front. The risks, I think, are primarily at this point, I think there's two. I think there's the price risk near term of some sort of offshore exchange blow up. We read some of that around the Tether issues that have been discussed. The leverage that is in some of these offshore exchanges is pretty extreme. And so if there was some sort of regulatory issue, you could see a pretty dramatic drawdown in the short run on that. The other thing I think is that ultimately, to the extent that Bitcoin is doing a much more effective job of helping people sort of preserve wealth outside the system and go up in price, you could see regulatory pressures from the US government to basically, I don't think they can shut down Bitcoin. They could, in theory, close the on-ramps or off-ramps into the SWIFT system or the dollar banking system. I don't think that would be wise. I think that would cause a bigger crisis than it would resolve, but that doesn't mean the US government couldn't try to do that. And so I think that's also a risk.
All right, all right. And presumably not a big enough risk at this time for you to be, you know, lightening up on your positions. So, all right. So, Luke, I'm going to ask you now. I would love to have you back on at some point in 2021. I feel like it's been a wonderful interview, but also I feel like, you know, we probably addressed maybe a tenth of the questions I'd love to ask in picking your brain. But let's end on the really important one that I'm sure most viewers have at the top of their minds right now, which is, okay, if the future unfolds the way that Luke sees, you know, what asset classes, what strategies should I be considering and talking about with my, you know, financial advisor? You know, where do you think the big opportunities are going to be either for safety or growth or whatever going forward?
So I've really thought about this from a client standpoint, from my own standpoint in what I've called a Jacob Fugger model. So there's the man in history, Jacob Fugger, F-U-G-G-E-R, who's one of, if not the richest man in history on an inflation adjusted basis. And I want to say he was in the 1500s maybe, but at any rate, the point is this, is he once said, you take 25%, or you take your net worth and you take 25% in cash, 25% in gold, 25% in real estate, 25% in, I'm pretty sure it was stocks. And then you rebalance as needed. And so for me, the 25% that's in cash, I would say that's probably pretty high for these days. Maybe the right number is 15 or 20%. It gives you that optionality. It takes away that left tail of deflation that we talked about. And just in case, look, I could be wrong. You could have some sort of political change where they do let people twist in the wind for a year and asset prices absolutely collapse, et cetera. I don't think that's likely, but that takes away that left tail risk. The gold, I would say when you talk about that in that model of gold, I think it's gold, it's Bitcoin, it's silver, some combination, whatever it is that you're comfortable with. And that's really, to me, I've increasingly almost looked at Bitcoin as my gold and my gold as my bonds in some ways. Because once you're at 0% interest rates or negative interest rates, gold is
about the same, right?
Yeah.
They're not paying anything.
No. And gold is a 0% yielding bond of infinite duration, right? So, you know, gold's price has no limit on its upside. Bonds can only go up so much, before they don't make sense anymore in terms of face value. So I think that 25% of gold, you know, cash or gold, Bitcoin, silver, and then real estate, the 25%, I think is still very valid. I think it's a little bit of a trickier game than it was a couple years ago, both between the changes that are being brought on secularly by things that Amazon's doing to light retail, things that COVID has done to commercial working spaces. We're seeing those sort of change in real time, the relationship between workers and office space, et cetera. And so I think you look for a real estate that benefits from the potential for new working arrangements. And we can see that happening sort of real time as well. Real estate right now in San Francisco and in New York City is not doing well. Real estate in Miami or Hilton Head or these sort of, you know, Montana, more attractive places where people want to be, where they can work remotely, it's absolutely booming. And so I think real estate's always been a sort of a location game. But I think the broad brush of, hey, real estate last 40 years, you sort of just, you know, buy something and ride the yield curve down and everybody makes money in real estate. I think those days are probably, it's much more of a stock picker's market, if you will, in real estate going forward. But I think you want sort of niche real estate things that make sense there for somebody. And then stocks, I think you want a blend of commodities, commodity companies, industrials, big tech, and some foreign stocks as well. And then you just rebalance. So it says 25, 25, 25, 25. And I think you're sort of, and it's interesting because that's been the model for the Fugger portfolio was a loose model for Ray Dalio's all weather portfolio, if I'm not mistaken. So that really is all weather portfolio.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is great. Thank you so much, Luke, for giving us so much of your time, such great insights and perspective, and getting really in the details there of the portfolio allocation part. That's what we really, you know, it's one of the main reasons why we do these videos, is we want to give people sort of actionable ideas to think about, you know, again, go talk with their professional financial advisors about, because everybody is trying to figure out how do they navigate this incredibly distorted world we had here. David Stockman wrote a book called The Great Deformation, which really is all about, you know, the central planners and what they're doing here to, you know, push things at a macro level. But of course, it's just stretched all sorts of historic valuations to unprecedented levels now, right? And everyone's trying to sort of navigate this new normal. And is it a new normal? Or, you know, is it not different this time? And, you know, these bubbles are going to have some sort of violent correction. We're all still figuring this out, but you've given us lots of great stuff to think about, Luke. Last question for you is, for people who've really enjoyed this conversation, where can they go to learn more about you and your work?
Absolutely. They can find us at fftt-llc.com. It's our website. Check out, if you're interested in our retail product offering, Tree Rings. We've got a special actually going on now through the weekend, but it's a 10 most interesting things list with synopsis of key things that we're seeing and how they impact or could impact portfolios and some of the key ongoing themes that that we see developing in markets. So, but it's at fftt-llc.com, and I also have a pretty active Twitter feed at Luke Groman on Twitter.
Awesome. And when we edit this, I'll put the URLs to those different channels. All right, Luke, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to free you up and let you go. But again, I hope we can have you back on sometime later in 2021.
Yeah, I'd love to. Absolutely. Just reach out, and happy to do so. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, it was a total pleasure. All right. Well, John and Mike, guys, I feel like I say this every week, but another week, another amazing guest on this program. Luke was just a total joy. Again, I mentioned he, for folks watching, he was at the top of the list for guests that you guys have been asking for, and boy, did he deliver. So thank you for recommending him. And again, you know, I do listen to your feedback. So if there are other guests you want to see on the program, please let me know on my Twitter feed, at Menlo Bear, and I'll repeat that at the end of this video here. But with the New Harbor guys, why don't we get started? Mike, I'll hand the football to you. We don't have a ton of time left. And that's good news, bad news, because Luke was such a great guest. But, you know, he mentioned the activity that's gone on today. Certainly, you know, a more volatile day in the markets than we've seen of late. What should folks know about what the markets have done since we met a week ago?
Well, Adam, I think one thing I'd say is, even though we, you know, we talk about the market being more volatile, or we say that this is a big move, I mean, it's nothing. It's really nothing. You know, the market's down 1%. We're getting so used to straight up markets and no volatility that we get kind of spoiled, you know, in my view.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but Luke mentioned, yeah, we had a crisis at the end of 2018 in the markets. And I was like, it was a hiccup. If you look at it at the long-term chart of the S&P, you know, it's just a tiny little blip.
It's nothing. We've gotten completely spoiled. And, you know, 2008 is so far in the past that it's kind of hard to remember. But, you know, markets are more overvalued and more dangerous than they were then, you know, and well, he's fantastic and brilliant. Luke, it's just the amount of knowledge he has just blows me away. It's very impressive. You know, the difficulty that we have as money managers is like, how do we apply all of this stuff? How do we apply all this knowledge? You know, we know that valuations have never been higher. We know that central bankers have never been more desperate. Every single conversation we have with folks is, you know, some kind of discussion about, how do we know it really isn't different this time? How do we know the Fed can't keep it up? We just know the Fed's going to keep printing. Okay, so how do we apply that? That's tough. I mean, our portfolio isn't that much different than the one he was describing at the end, where he was talking about breaking a portfolio up into fourths or 25%. We have a little more cash than, you know, what he was describing there, but we're big believers in real things, tangible assets, gold and silver, you know, certainly can be as high as, you know, a quarter of one's portfolio on the high end. And of course, real estate, farmland, other tangibles, not very many stocks at all. We just feel like that this is one of those times in history where you can really point at stocks and say, they may go higher, but they've never been more expensive ever. And there's never been more euphoria. And frankly, there's never been a time where it's felt more like this time is different. And everyone's saying it, everyone believes it. It's the hallmark of a bubble. That's every conversation embodies that same thing. They can't stop printing. They'll never let it go down. The stock market is too important to the U.S. economy, all of which is true. our opinion is that they will fail. There'll be a moment of justice. And yes, we think that long-term inflation is probably very likely. There's very few other ways out, but short-term, like 0 to 2 years, we think that deflation still probably gets out of hand. We're not going to have the kind of printing that has been described with a lot of financial writers lately, including in this conversation, I don't think, without a major, you know, major price collapse, deflationary scare, something's going to have to happen. And that's what we're managing so defensively for, to be able to take advantage of that. Well, number one, not get hurt by that. And number two, to take advantage of that. So I'll just, you know, finish my comments by saying, you know, the S&P started to go down a little bit. It's off 60 points on the week. A lot of people aren't noticing the dollar's taking off a little bit. That's some short-term pressure on gold. But in our view, gold is getting down to that area, 1680 to 1720, which is a pretty major support area. So opportunistically, people could add to gold holdings if they don't have any. Now's a good time to think about it. And we don't know when we're going to get more opportunity in the stock market, but it certainly seems like it's getting closer by the day.
Great. So yeah, two questions. One is, you mentioned the precious metals. Gold, you know, has weakened over the past month, 2 months, just cracked below 1700, at least last time I looked at it. So it's becoming more attractive. You just told people if you don't have it, now's a good time to start, you know, nibbling away. Is there kind of a back up the truck price that you guys have where, like, if gold and or silver drop below whatever, we're going to really step in big?
I think that question was directed to me, so I'll answer it. You look at the breakout level, you know, when we had the flush last March, silver got down to 1213. I'd like to say we'd get there and back up the truck. I don't think that's ever going to happen again. I mean, obviously, I may be wrong, but I don't think so. If you take a look at gold, you know, it was down like in the 14, 1500 level. And here we are at 1690 or so. We go down another $50, $100, you know, $1,650, $1,600, the amount of us telling people to back up the truck, I'm not sure we're ever going to say back up the truck, but we may start suggesting stronger and stronger until we start pounding the table a little bit and say that these are pretty good prices, you know. So anywhere in this range, it's really not, you don't have to be that exact about it. If you're going to put $10,000 or $20,000 or $50,000 into gold, there's not a huge difference between buying right now and buying 100 points lower. You know, the risk is to be left out and miss the pullback.
Right, right. You want to be in it for when the moment that we're all, the macro moment we're all waiting for happens. You know, you get to participate in it. I will say, you know, we're talking about gold, but you know, we really mean all the precious metals plus the miners. And we don't need to go into it because we've mentioned it a lot in past the strategy in past months. But you guys have a sizable position in the gold mining companies. Last time we were on, you guys had basically said, because you know the precious metals were beginning to weaken, that you guys were right at the point where your protective options that you have on the miners were going to, you know, dramatically limit any further weakness in price there. And I just want to remind folks that you know, New Harbor, and in my opinion, any financial advisor who's worth their salt, you know, they hedge their big positions defensively so that when you have these moments in the market where the trade is going in the opposite direction you want it to, you're limiting your downside risk. And it underscores, you know, what Luke was talking about, where he gave that example of Germany, right, of what happened in Germany, and basically said, you know, it was so volatile that you couldn't just have a set it and forget it strategy. You needed to be aware of what was going on the ground. And that's, I think, what a huge role of aware financial advisors like you guys, Mike and John, provide is you give, you know, basically what I heard from Luke was work with a financial advisor who, you know, is like dedicated to watching this, is laser focused on the, you know, different dimensions that are shifting, and is being nimble and knowing when to have you in, when to have you out, when to be, you know, when which sectors are weakening, which sectors are strengthening, and is applying an overall risk management protective layer to the whole thing. All right. So with that said, John, let me hand things to you. You know, feel free to comment on anything that either Luke or Mike just mentioned, but also I'd love it if you could kind of comment on, I know that you've had a number of people come in over the past week in terms of, you know, folks coming over from these Peak Prosperity videos to you guys. It seems that people are really you know, I call it maybe animal spirits, but I think we're getting a sense both amongst ourselves, but amongst aware people like us, that they're picking up on the fact that, you know, it feels like, you know, almost like the electricity in the air before a thunderstorm. That I think that the aware people are sensing that change, maybe imminent change, maybe afoot. If you can comment on anything like that you're seeing in people, that our viewers can kind of understand, you know, what people like them types of concerns are coming in with, please do.
Happy to. You know, we've talked at length about some of the kind of hallmarks that, you know, we often look for in like major extreme markets, and certainly there are plenty of them there. But yeah, I mean, you look at, you know, stocks like Tesla, for example, which, you know, is up a tremendous amount without any real solid analytical basis for that. You know, there's lots of words that people can use to justify it, but when you actually look at the business case and the fundamentals that underlie it, no way can that stock be justified where it is today. And it's off, you know, it peaked out, earlier this year at 900. It's at 621, we're closed today. So you're starting to see some of these things that have lured folks in with, you know, seemingly unbreakable armor, starting to see some, you know, some chinks in the armor. The ARK fund, which is a, you know, high-flying ETF, but, you know, managed by ARK Investments, Cathie Wood has become a rock star. You know, it's amazing how concentrated that stock, that those holdings are in some of these, you know, companies that are just valuations that are just untethered to reality, and the manner in which even the firm itself that sponsors that fund is out in the airwaves every day, you know, touting, hey, you know, we're up huge, but we're going to see 20% annual returns going forward. It's just the kind of the gloating and the hubris is just remarkable, frankly. It's reminiscent of, say, some of the stuff you saw in 2000 with the tech bubble, crescendo. You know, I thought Luke was great. You know, what a lucid, logical, thinker and commentator, but also breaking it down into very simple terms. Imagine if the Federal Reserve Chair and the Federal Reserve governors talked so clearly and lucidly about the state of affairs. It would be quite a gift, I think, to the society they're supposed to serve. It's just incredibly fresh words from him. And, you know, man, you know, and he connects the dots, you know, the thought that a stock market, you know, retreat of size, which is every bit, you know, likely and possible and justified by where the data shows we are, could, you know, cause the U.S. government to default in a few months. I mean, that is just, it should be quaking for most people to hear that. And this is not an extreme, you know, perspective. It's, you know, what the reality of the situation is. So the things like gold, absolutely, we view it like an insurance policy. And, you know, our use of hedging, you know, I think is emblematic of our, we're not dogmatically, you know, religious about it. We can see when there are times where the price behavior deserves and warrants some, you know, kind of belt and suspenders. And we're in one of those times for a lot of the reasons Mike already mentioned. But you know, when you think about the swings there that have happened in like that Weimar Germany example and the reality, you know, when you think about it as an insurance policy rather than an investment, we tell folks don't even worry what price you pay, have some, because just like you don't worry the price you pay necessarily for your life insurance or your house insurance, it's stuff you got to have, right? We kind of look at gold, physical gold and precious metals in much the same way.
All right. Well, really well said. I hate to have to wind things up here, but we've run late. And of course, we've run late for great reasons by keeping Luke on a bit longer than we thought we were going to be able to. One thing we can get into more next week, but I just sort of want to flag it here, is from week to week, we keep note of the sort of legendary and very mainstream wise investors who come out and say, hey, this is the craziest market I've seen in my entire investing career. We've heard that from many, many storied investors. I mentioned Jeremy Grantham earlier this video, but we've mentioned a number more in the past. I just wanted to add two names to it. So Elliott Management, Paul Singer, who is a very successful billionaire investor. I've got several quotes from him, but I'll just read this quick one. "We believe that hindsight will show the champion of head-smacking craziness in the American stock market to be the period playing out right now." So that's Paul Singer. And then Warren Buffett, whom I think everybody knows, recently penned in his Berkshire annual report. Eventually, of course, the party ends and many business emperors are found to have no clothes. Financial history is replete with the names of famous conglomerateurs who were initially lionized as business geniuses by journalists, analysts, and investment bankers, but whose creations ended up as business junkyards. And this is just yet another way for these people who have seen many more market cycles than most people alive and have profited the most by, you know, surviving them well. They're saying that this is the craziest that they've ever seen, and don't get lulled into the siren song that it's different this time. Either that new technologies like Tesla or Bitcoin or whatever are going to make the old rules moot, or that the Fed is all powerful and is going to be able to prevent any sort of, you know, market decline going forward. So with that, guys, we'll have to leave it here for the week. Whatever happens next, I'll be watching it closely with you, and we'll be reporting it on it weekly in these videos. Wrapping things up real quick for folks. Please, if you haven't yet, subscribe to this channel. The subscribe button's right down there, right under the like button. Click the little bell icon next to the subscribe button as well. That'll make sure you get alerted when these new videos come out, so you won't have to hunt around for them. Click the like button while you're down there. It actually does make a difference in how widely these videos get shared. If you haven't yet, follow me on Twitter at Menlo Bear. Like I said, I listened very closely to your recommendations. That's why we had Luke on this week. I also announce our upcoming guests early there. So if you're curious to find out who's going to be on, go follow me there at Twitter. And then last and most importantly, the guys here at New Harbor Financial, John and Mike, for over a decade now, they have been offering a free, absolutely no commitment consultation to the folks that watch these videos, to the Peak Prosperity audience. They do it literally as a public service just to help people hopefully be able to position themselves to sidestep a lot of the volatility and potential damages that may be coming that we just talked about here with Luke. If you have any interest in having one of those free consultations, they'll sit down with you, they'll hear about your whole financial situation and give you their customized recommendation of what you think you should be doing. If you're interested in that, just stick around to the end of this video. We'll tell you how to raise your hand and sign up for one of those quick conversations with them. And the process only takes about 20 seconds or so. All right, guys, so with that said, who knows? Maybe today was the start of something interesting in the markets. But like I said, no matter what happens, we'll be back here next week to talk about it. Thanks for sticking around, Mike and John. Great to have you guys on as usual.
Thanks, Adam. See you next week.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to greylockpeak.com. These consultations are completely free and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given the latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth and because Peak Prosperity has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. Chris and I started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration and are looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or just downright ridiculed by the standard sort of financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type, the kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry, the market's always going to take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing, which is why we strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you'll work with, just as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you aren't, or you're having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. And for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Peak Prosperity and New Harbor, which we had to put in place to make sure that everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the greylockpeak.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-U.S. clients. All right. With all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to greylockpeak.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.